Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. My name is Edgar Lujano, one of the producers for the live show and filling in for Cy Kellett today on this wonderful Friday afternoon, no, evening. Afternoon, evening, late afternoon, early evening. I don't know. What do you think, Jimmy?
Depends on where you are.
That's true. Or morning if you're in Australia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, there are a few lines up, and if you want to talk to Jimmy today, we have a whole hour. So let's go. 888-318-7884. I'll say it a little more slow for those for people like me who probably need it slower, 888-318-7884. So we talked about Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World in the first hour. So let me ask you about the Jimmy Akin podcast. What's going on? Well, on Monday.
Oh, sure. Well, first, though, I wanted to compliment you on saying the phone number at a human speed and clearly enunciating it. Mary Poppins would be proud.
Oh, thank you. That's all I need. I can die happy.
Now, if you say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious loud enough, you'll always sound precocious, though.
I don't even know if I can say the word, so I'm not even going to
So coming up on the Jimmy Akin podcast this coming Monday, I have a look at a subject that I primarily deal with: how Jewish people reckoned the start and the end of the day. You often hear that Jewish people in the Jewish reckoning that the day begins at sunset, and then so you have evening first and then morning. And there's an element of truth to that, but it's actually more complicated than that. And so I'm going to talk about the different practices that different groups of Jews have used throughout history regarding reckoning the day. And one of the reasons I'm talking about that is because you often hear that the ability to go to a vigil mass on Saturday evening is because the Jewish day begins at sunset. And so it's like, if you go to a vigil mass on Saturday evening, we're kind of following an ancient Jewish practice. But and I'm going to tell you the real story about that and how the custom of doing vigil masses got introduced and what, if anything, it has to do with when the Jewish day begins.
Okay, great. I wanted to ask you then, does that also have some correlation to when we count the 3 days of from Jesus' death to the resurrection as well? Or is that something completely different?
No, the timing of those days does depend on which reckoning system you're using. Mm. So one of the things you'll notice in the Gospels, now Jesus gets crucified on Friday afternoon, and they point out, that one of the evangelists, that they had to do the burial in haste because the Sabbath was beginning. Mm. And that tells us that at least this group of Jews at this time was treating the Sabbath as beginning at sundown on Friday. But that is not the universal practice among Jews.
Okay. Well, there you have it. If that piqued your interest, go to Jimmy Akin's YouTube channel. You can find it there.
YouTube.com/Jimmy Akin or in any of the standard podcast directories.
All right. There you have it. Perfect. Well, we got a few lines open. So if you want to go ahead and give us a call, 888-318-7884. We go to Robert in Illinois, listening to us on the Catholic Answers Live app. Robert, you are on the air with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Are the 12 stars on the miraculous medal more for the 12 tribes or for the 12 apostles?
Well, that's something I can't really answer, because reportedly the miraculous medal was designed by was revealed to St. Catherine Laboure and reportedly designed by the Virgin Mary herself. So you'd have to ask Mary. And I can tell you where I think they come from. And that is that 12 stars is a common symbol of Mary, and that's based on Revelation chapter 12, where John sees the sign of a great woman in heaven, and she's wearing a crown of 12 stars. And she also has she's clothed with the sun and has the moon at her feet. And one, not the only thing, but one of the things that this woman represents is the Virgin Mary. And so since then, in Christian iconography, 12 stars associated with a woman has been a symbol of Mary. And so I would assume that, you know, either the Virgin Mary herself or St. Catherine Laboure's subconscious or some combination of those two was responsible for her seeing the design of the miraculous medal is included in these 12 stars. Now, there's a further backstory to where the 12 stars come from, because that symbolism of sun, moon, and 12 stars itself comes from the Old Testament. If you look in Genesis chapter 37, Joseph, the patriarch Joseph, as a boy, is having these dreams. And his first dream is that he and his brothers are harvesting grain, and each one of them has a sheaf of grain, and all of their sheaves of grain bow down to Joseph's, which is a sign that Joseph is going to, in the future — this is a precognitive dream, he's going to have some kind of preeminence over them in the future. And he tells them this story, and they get honked off. But then he has another dream, and in this other dream, he dreams that there are these stars that are bowing down to him, along with the sun and the moon. And the meaning of this is obvious. The sun represents his father Jacob, the moon represents his mother, and the stars represent his brothers. So, his father Jacob even is incredulous when he hears this dream and says, "What do you think, your mom and I are going to really be bowing down to you?" But yeah, they are going to be. This is the beginning of the Joseph narrative in Genesis, and it does end up with his brothers paying him homage, his family in general paying him homage. So this dream is right, and consequently, the image of the sun, the moon, and 12 stars represents the patriarch Joseph, Joseph's mother, and the 12 tribes of Israel. And so, and then later, Jesus based the 12 apostles apparently on the 12 tribes of Israel. So I would say that the 12 stars that appear on the miraculous medal are most directly based on Revelation 12, which is itself based on Genesis 37. But that doesn't stop us from saying that those 12 stars from Genesis 37 represent the 12 tribes. They do. And I don't see any reason to exclude them in principle from also referring to the 12 apostles, whose number is based on the 12 tribes. So I would say, you know, it's all of the above.
It's a good clarification for me.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Great. Thanks for the question, Robert. All right, let's go to the break, and then we'll come back and take some more questions. There's going to be one line open if you want to ask Jimmy a question. 888-318-7884.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Pope Francis tells us, becoming a priest or a man or woman religious is not primarily our own decision. Rather, it's the response to a call of love. Do you feel as if God may be calling you to religious life? If so, contact a religious order faithful to the magisterium or your diocesan vocation. For information on the priesthood or religious life, visit ewtn.com/religious life today.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Once again, Edgar Lujano, producer for the show, filling in for Cy Kellett. It's an Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin, so let's go back to the calls since there's plenty of calls on hold. We go to Joseph in Arlington, Virginia, also listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Joseph, go right ahead with your question.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I wanted to present to you an ethical dilemma that I've been struggling with recently. So basically, I'm sure you might be familiar with the dead donor rule, which is endorsed by the Catholic Church. The dead donor rule states that an organ donor's death is defined at the cessation of neurological function brain death. However, the dead donor can still metabolize nutrients with the support of extraordinary means. He's still a whole organism, and he's, of course, still human. So how come when it's an organ donor, they're dead, but when it's an unborn baby, they're alive?
Okay, so I would say a couple things here. The first one is the neurological criteria of brain death as a determinative for physical death is debated in the Catholic Church. There was a document that came out towards the end of John Paul II's reign that said when brain activity has stopped, you know, irreversibly in an individual, that the rest of their body is going to disintegrate, you know, anyway, because the brain's no longer organizing it. And therefore, you can use that as a criterion for determination of physical death and thus organ donation. But at least for those organs that you can't live without, you know, you can donate things like kidneys, you know, while you're alive, and it's no problem because you only need one kidney, so you can donate the other if need be. But very quickly after this document was released, there was pushback from Catholic bioethicists, who, not all of them, but from some of them, who thought that brain death is an inadequate criterion for physical death. And they cited various things in that regard. One of them is just exactly the factors that you mentioned. The body is still alive. So I would say somatic death, which soma is Greek for body, somatic death has not occurred when you know, the essential forms of brain function have ceased. And we don't really know how irreversible some of this is, and the medical profession right now cannot be trusted with adequately diagnosing brain death because there is an anti-life ethic in much of the medical community that wants to declare a person dead as soon as possible so they can harvest the organs and stop charging the insurance company. And so very quickly, Pope Benedict the 16th said, yeah, there can still be debate on this. So this is actually a debated issue in the Catholic Church.
So you mentioned irreversibility. So let's say that the patient, the brain dead patient who is an organ donor, their state of neurological cessation is irreversible. Then would you definitively know that they're dead?
Well, I would. So if you're asking my opinion here, I would say no.
Yeah.
Because I'm on the side that says brain death does not determine somatic death. And so consequently, if you're talking about an unborn child and he has metabolism, I would say, yeah, he's alive. And if you've got a person, even if they've lost brain function, as long as their body still has metabolism, I would say somatic death has not occurred and this person is not really dead yet. So that's my opinion, but it is not the opinion that that others have. So there's a diversity of opinion here. And I tend to err on the side of caution. And I can see why where someone might try to draw a distinction here and say, well, with an unborn child, they may not have brain function now, but they have not irreversibly lost it. and their body in the unborn state, before they even develop a brain, is not dependent on the brain the way an adult person's body is dependent on the brain. And so if you lose, so there is a distinction here that if you have an unborn child that has not yet developed a brain, their life is not dependent on it. But if you have an adult whose body has become dependent on their brain and they lose brain function, then their body will soon die. So there is a distinction to be drawn here between the two situations. But my inclination is to err on the side of safety. And as long as the person still has metabolism, say, yeah, they cannot safely be declared dead, and we can't cut them up for parts.
And you also mentioned somatic death. Is somatic death mm-hmm. commensurate to spiritual death?
Well, spiritual death is a term that is generally used to refer to the removal of sanctifying grace from the soul. And so someone spiritually dead, if they don't have sanctifying grace in their soul, but they're spiritually alive if they do have sanctifying grace in their soul. So that's how that term is used, and it wouldn't have anything to do with bodily death. You can be both spiritually alive and physically alive. You can be both physically alive and spiritually dead. You can be both spiritually alive and physically dead, and you can be spiritually alive and physically alive. So you've got a whole square of opposition there. They don't, they're two separate issues. If you mean something like dead from God's perspective, or what you might call theological death, that's something that is even less well-defined than physical death. We do have the statement in James chapter 2 that the body without the spirit is dead, but we can't empirically detect the spirit, so we have to rely on proxies, like does this person have metabolism, or do they have a function in brain, or do they have a function in heart, or things like that. And we have to kind of use those proxies for when a person is really most sincerely dead, and kind of leave the exact determination of when someone is really most sincerely dead up to God.
So when someone is somatically dead, it's implied that their soul has separated from their body.
That is the assumption on which these calculations are based, or these considerations are based.
All right, Joseph, thank you so much for your question. We're going to go ahead and move on from there. We go over to Steve in Canada, who's listening on Catholic.com. Steve, go right ahead with your question.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Go
right ahead. My question is hypothetical. So considering that all the cardinals will be meeting at the Vatican to elect a new pope, mm-hmm. or for that matter, at any election of a new pope, who would elect the next pope if, let's assume, the cardinals were kidnapped and killed, including the Carmelengo, the auxiliary bishop of Rome, and those cardinals that are 80 years of age or more? In a case scenario as such, who would be in charge of organizing the election of the new pope, or how would the election of the head of the church take place?
So Steve, let me ask a clarifying question. In the scenario that you just described, are any of the College of Cardinals left alive?
No.
Okay, so we've wiped out all the cardinals. The answer is that the law does not currently provide for this. People always wonder about these science fiction scenarios, and frankly, I wish the popes would worry about them a little more too. Now, the odds of something like this happening, being able to kill all the cardinals in the world all at once before any new cardinals could be appointed, that's kind of a very improbable situation. But improbable things can happen. And so, you know, if I were Pope, and by the way, if elected, I refuse to serve. That's my standard response on that question. But if if I were Pope, I would give thought to having a document somewhere that specifies what would happen in situations like this. Like, what if someone, you know, all the cardinals are meeting there and someone drops a nuke on St. Peter's Basilica and kills them all? What do you do then? Well, I'd like to have provisions for that situation. One of the provisions that I would likely make is I would want to have some of the over 80s in an undisclosed location for safety purposes during the conclave, so that if something happens in the main location, the over 80s can come out of the undisclosed location. This is the same, and this is why, you know, during crises here in America, the president and the vice president and or some member of the cabinet has to be in a protected location. You can't get everybody together all at once in a crisis. And I would tend to do the same thing with the College of Cardinals. But thus far, so far as we know, there is no such document specifying that. So we would be in a case that is beyond the law. We'd be in uncharted territory. Now, I think what would happen, and this is all speculation, but I think what would happen is there would be some kind of consultation among the next highest ranking folks in the church, because it's going to be hard without an ecumenical council to gather all of the bishops. But I suspect what would happen is there would be some kind of consultation, an emergency consultation, among the surviving archbishops who were not cardinals. And they would probably produce a mechanism, maybe either by having the archbishops gather or some subset of the archbishops would be nominated to hold a new conclave, and they would then elect a new pope. But this is speculative because we've never been in this situation and the law doesn't provide for it. But I suspect that the next people down in the hierarchy, namely the archbishops, would be tasked with coming up for an emergency election mechanism in this situation. And I suspect it wouldn't be a full consultation of bishops because there are too many of them. But even with the archbishops, I suspect they might designate certain people to do the conclave, like some subset of the archbishops.
Steve?
Yes. Thank you for that response. That was very insightful.
Yeah, no problem. I think about these science fiction scenarios all the time.
Well, the thing that's in my head now is, what would happen, not that you would accept the election, Jimmy, but what would happen if you become a pope? Would there be a blend between a mitre and a cowboy hat? That's the real question.
Well, you probably, you know, I've got multiple hats, so I could add a mitre to the collection, and I'd wear it on mitre appropriate occasions.
There you go. Perfect. All right, Steve, thanks for that fun scenario. We're not going to go to the next call real quick. I just want to reiterate this pitch that Carrie gave me, because it's such a great deal right now over at shop.catholic.com. All of Jimmy's books, actually all of the books that we have right now at shop.catholic.com are on sale specifically for Easter week. So go ahead and head on over. You can get great books, like all the 20 Answers books, by the way. The Fathers Know Best, Teaching with Authority, The Bible is a Catholic Book, A Daily Defense, The Drama of Salvation, and all of our new ones that are out as well. You can get on sale right now. And just for this weekend only, we have the promo code SHOWERS, and you can get an extra 20% off the already discounted books. So make sure you head on over to shop.catholic.com and pick up some books as maybe an Easter gift to yourself or a loved one, especially for those who had just gone through RCIA and are officially confirmed and have entered into the Catholic faith. So it's something great to get for them as well. Shop.catholic.com. Now, Jimmy, before we go to the break, because we do have about 1 minute left, you had mentioned your recent episode on the Jimmy Akin podcast, but I was looking on the YouTube channel, and there's one that piqued my interest. I think you partially covered that, is who can receive communion at...
That was last week's.
Last week's, okay. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. I was at a Mormon... church, I guess, Mormon church, and still the offering. So can Catholics receive communion at other places? I guess softball question for you.
It depends on is the sacrament valid or not. Now, in Eastern Orthodox or Oriental Orthodox communions, they have valid sacraments. And so there are situations like if a Catholic is not able to, let's say you're in the middle of an Eastern Orthodox country, there are no Catholic parishes around, you could go to an Eastern Orthodox church and receive there. On the other hand, if the sacrament is not valid in a particular church, and this is going to be the case in the overwhelming majority of Protestant churches and also in Mormon churches, then you can't receive it there. The sacrament needs to be valid, and there are some other conditions that need to be met. But the fundamental one is the sacrament valid in the church you're at? If it is, then it's at least a possibility. But if it's not, it is not a possibility.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jimmy, for that. Appreciate that. All right, well, we're going to go to the hard break. And when we come back, we're going to have more questions. It's an Ask Me Anything Catholicism with Jimmy Akin. Give us a call, 888-318-7884.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers. And now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
On Monday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, our topic will be Give Me Your Best Clean Joke. And now, back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. And the lines continue to be full, so we jump back in with Alyssa in Austin, Texas, listening to Armor of God Radio. Alyssa, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. So my question is related to the LDS Church. I've been talking mm-hmm. with a Mormon friend, mm-hmm. and she quoted these two Bible verses that I hadn't really heard before. Mm-hmm. As evidence of the Mormon belief in polytheism and that we will become gods after death or okay. can't become. Mm-hmm. So the verses, hold on, let me bring them up. The verses are Psalm 82:6, okay. and again, Jesus quotes it in John 10:31-33. Basically Jesus is talking to some Jews and they, criticize him for saying he's God. And he says, is it not written in your law? I have said, you are gods.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. I toddlers in the background.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good. It's better to have toddlers in the background than not to have toddlers in the background.
Yeah, it is.
So Alyssa, are you just wondering how to respond to these claims?
Yeah. How do I explain this verse in terms of Trinitarian theology and against the idea that we would become gods?
So the first thing to do, since we're dealing with an Old Testament text here that's then used in a New Testament text, which then needs to be related to Christian theology, is start with the original. Figure out what the original text means, then we can look at how it's used in the New Testament, and then we can figure out how it relates to theology. What we don't want to do is take a modern theology and read it backwards onto the text. That's eisegesis rather than exegesis. So in this case, we just starting with Psalm 82, it says, God presides in the great, this is starting with verse 1, it says, God presides in the great assembly, he renders judgment among the gods. Now, what this is referring to is what's known in scholarly literature as the divine council. One of the things that you find in ancient Near Eastern literature is that the high god was pictured as a king, and kings are surrounded by their councils, you know, who are their officials. And so it was assumed that, well, okay, our God, you know, Yahweh, he's a great king, so he's going to have this divine council around him. And he's the high God, so any other heavenly beings up there are subordinate to him. And there's a question of, do you want to call them gods or not at that point? Now, today, we tend to use a different word for the subordinate heavenly beings. Today, we call them angels. But back then, they would call them gods. But they recognized there's a difference of kind between Yahweh, who's the infinite creator of everything, who's way above everybody else, and these lesser gods that, and they might say, okay, these other nations, you know, like the Moabites and the Egyptians and stuff like that, they have their gods, but they've got these little bitty gods that are not comparable to the true creator, Yahweh. And so the image that Psalm 82 is using here is of Yahweh and his divine council. And so God is presiding in this council, in this great assembly, and it says he renders judgment among the gods. And then Yahweh says to the members of the divine assembly, how long will you defend the unjust and show partiality to the wicked? So he's charging them with doing bad stuff. He says, defend the weak and the fatherless, uphold the cause of the poor and the oppressed, rescue the weak and the needy, deliver them from the hand of the wicked. The gods know nothing. They understand nothing. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. And Yahweh says, I said you are gods. You are all sons of the Most High. But you will die like mere mortals. You will fall like every other ruler. And then the psalmist says, rise up, O God, judge the earth, for all the nations are your inheritance. So this is based on an idea that we find in a number of places in the Old Testament, that God has this heavenly council. They're referred to as the sons of God, even though they're really created beings, and today we call them angels. And he put them in charge of the other nations, but they've done bad stuff. Among other things, they've encouraged the people subject to them to worship them instead of the Creator. And so here, God is denouncing these so-called sons of God that are governing the nations, and he's like going to topple them. And the psalmist is encouraging this. It's like, rise up, God, the whole earth is yours. We don't need these other so-called gods or angels ruling these other nations. I mean, you take charge, God. You go, God. So that's basically what's happening in Psalm 32, according to its background with ancient Near Eastern literature. But not everyone agrees with that. There have been attempts to interpret the word Elohim, or gods, in this passage in a different sense, as referring to judges. So the idea here is that God is judging human rulers, like he's judging human judges and accusing them of misconduct. But that reading is really strained. It really does look like here we have God, the true God, the ultimate God, berating these other heavenly beings who in this context are called gods, but we today would call them angels. So I think that's what this psalm is referring to. So I would agree that this text does envision God as being part of the leader of a heavenly council that includes beings who are at least described as sons of God, even though today, as a Christian, I would classify them as created beings who are also angels. So that's what I'd have to say, unless something else occurs to me that's relevant to this Old Testament text. Then we move to the New Testament and Jesus's use of this in the Gospel of John. Now, as you point out, Jesus's critics have been objecting to him on the grounds that he makes himself equal with God. And he then cites Psalm 82, where Yahweh is depicted as saying to the members of the council, "You are gods." And Jesus says something very interesting. He says, "If therefore those to whom the word of God came can be called gods, then why are you objecting to me doing that?" Now, it's interesting. I find that it interesting that he uses the phrase "those to whom the word of God came," and that fits with Psalm 82 because Yahweh himself is talking to the member of the divine council when he says, "You're all gods. You're all sons of the Most High." So he's talking to them. So the word of God came to them. And so whatever else is the case about these beings that are being addressed in Psalm 82, they are those to whom the word of God came. God was talking to them. And so that sidesteps the issue of, are they really gods, or are they really angels, or are they really human judges? So Jesus is dodging the question, or at least one construction of this is he's dodging the question of what's the exact nature of these beings that are under discussion in Psalm 82. You could support any of those three theories I just mentioned. And so Jesus seems to be sidestepping that question and just saying, hey, look, the Old Testament calls people besides Yahweh God, so that can happen, so you shouldn't automatically be condemning me for making myself equal to God. And he's using this passage as what you might call a squelch to shut up his opponents by giving them a conundrum that they don't know how to solve, because it's undeniable the people in this psalm get called gods, and they are those to whom the word of God came. So I think that's what Jesus is doing in John's gospel with this passage. Now, how do we relate this to theology, to later theology? Well, Mormons have proposed that humans and God and angels are all the same species, and that it's possible for humans and angels to ultimately become gods of their own planets. But there's nothing in the text that says that. That is not in Psalm 82. That is not in John's gospel. Neither of the passages that we've talked about have said humans can progress to become gods of the same type that the Creator is. So that's something that they're reading into the text. They're not getting it out of the text. On the other hand, Christians, in their use of this text, if on the assumption that I think is correct, that these are lesser, in Psalm 82, are lesser heavenly beings than the Creator who rules them, today we'd simply call them angels. So, and we don't need to make assumptions about who can become a deity or what, or what's the exact relationship between angels and humans. On the Christian understanding, angels and humans are two different species. So humans do not become angels, and that is consistent. Now, with both of these texts, it's not proved by either of these texts, but it is consistent with them. So what I would say to your friend is that there are things that Christians can acknowledge here, but they are consistent with a Christian understanding of the divine Trinity, where there are these lesser beings that are sometimes in the Old Testament called gods, and sometimes they're called sons of God, and today we call them angels. But on the Christian view, we can't become them, and we certainly cannot become equal to the Creator. That's something that is nowhere envisioned in either testament. So that kind of sketches what I'd have to say to your friend if we were having a discussion of these points.
How's that, Alyssa?
Okay. That's really helpful. My only caveat is I've heard from, I think it's Joe Heschmeyer, that when the Bible says son of God, son of a dog, son of a, they mean is a dog, is God, that sort of thing. So I guess it would be like.
Well, I haven't heard what Joe may have said in that regard, so I can't really comment on that. But there are clearly uses of the phrase "son of" that imply a difference between what you're talking about. So, like when Jesus refers to his opponents as sons of the devil, it doesn't mean that his opponents are literally demonic entities. They're clearly humans. So the phrase "son of" has a wide meaning, and it doesn't imply identicality between the son and what's being referred to, in not in all contexts. It may in some, but in others, like, for example, a Hebrew idiom in the Old Testament is sons of the South. And that just means Southerners. So the Judeans were from the southern tribe of Judah. They could be called sons of the South or Southerners. But they were not identical with the South. The South is a direction of the compass. It is not a person. Similarly, Judas is referred to as the son of destruction, but he's not himself destruction. He's a human being. So even though in some situations a son may be equal to the father in one sense, that doesn't mean that someone described as a son is equal to, much less identical with, what they're a son of in all contexts. You have to go context by context.
Alyssa, thank you so much for your question. We're going to go ahead and leave that right there because it's time for the final break. And when we come back, we'll finish it off with Jimmy Akin.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Back to the phones we go, because there's only a few minutes left. We go over to Roberto in Southern California, watching on YouTube. Roberto, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. You know, I was listening to the question, just this prior one, and mm-hmm. if I may chime in with my idea here, what was my opinion?
Okay.
You know, when it comes down to this Mormon stuff, it is very clear that the Bible, the Word of God, is true, because it says that this gospel will be preached to the whole world as a witness to all nations, and then shall the end come. And there are much more that prove that. But, so, you know, we ought to believe the Bible, you know, because it's true. And also, let's recall...
Roberto, how can I be of service to you?
Okay, no, yeah, I was just going to make this comment real quick. I was going to ask you a question. But, like, in Galatians, it says that whoever comes with another gospel, let's not listen to them. So, you know, it's obvious that Mormons come with another gospel. Okay, so moving that aside. I also listened to the gentleman. His name was Robert. I remember because it's Roberto, right? So he said his question was about the 12 stars on the crown of the Virgin Mary. Now, in Revelation chapter 1, I mean, Revelation 21 speaks of this subject further. But it says that the 12 crowns, the crown and the 12 stones are for each tribe of Israel. And it says that the bride coming down out of heaven is the new Jerusalem. What do you think of that?
What passage are you referring to?
So in Revelation chapter 12, verse 1, it says that a sign appeared in heaven, right?
Right.
And it says that a woman with a crown and 12 stars, right? And in Revelation chapter 21, it goes further to describe who this woman is. And it says that it's New Jerusalem, with the crown being the stones of the 12 tribes of Israel. That's why he mentioned that, I think.
Well, it doesn't mention a crown in Revelation 21. That word does not appear in that chapter.
You know what? I don't recall the crown, but it says it does say that it's 12 stones, 12 gates, 12 angels.
Well, yeah, it does. It does describe this. This is Revelation 21:12. It says that the city New Jerusalem, had a high wall with 12 gates, and with 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And there were 3 gates on the east, 3 on the north, 3 on the south, and 3 on the west. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. We're also elsewhere told that the gates were made out of giant pearls, which is why you'll hear people describe them as the pearly gates, because they're made out of giant pearls. And the foundations of the city are made out of different precious stones. But so that's what Revelation 21 says. What's your question about it?
Well, because if you start from verse 9, it says that one of the 7 angels who had the 7 bowls with the 7 last plagues came to me saying, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And so he carried me to the heaven, and out of heaven came, you know, it was because this refers in Revelation 12, it refers that a sign appeared in heaven. And right here is describing a woman in heaven, but it's the bride. And it goes on to consequently describe the 12, that, you know, everything described, because God speaks in parables, you know, so this is clearly fitting. Now,
so what's your question for me?
If Revelation 12 speaks of the Virgin Mary, is there another witness to that?
If Revelation 12 speaks of the Virgin Mary, is there another witness to Revelation 12 speaking of the Virgin Mary? Is that the question?
That's it, yes, clearly, yes, thank you.
Well, there are certainly a lot of people who have interpreted Revelation 12 as being about Mary. I mean, the text itself indicates that she gives birth to this man-child whose destiny is to rule the nations. And in context, Revelation 12 associates the man-child with, that means a male child is all that means. The male child is associated with ruling with a rod of iron, which is a symbol of the Davidic kingdom in the Old Testament. And so it's clear that this woman gives birth to Jesus. So one of the things she represents is the Virgin Mary. That is not the only thing she represents. I think you're correct that the Bride of the Lamb that we see in Revelation chapters 21 is also linked in 22 is also an elaboration of this image of the woman, and that represents the church, the New Jerusalem, the community of the saved. There are other possible images you can see here in addition, like the original Eve, because in Revelation 12 we have a conflict between a woman, her seed, and the serpent, and that reflects the Proto-Evangelium from Genesis 3. And you can also see the woman as a symbol of the Jewish people. So I think between Eve, Mary, the church, and the Jewish people, this woman has multiple meanings, which are brought out by different aspects of the text. I think the weakest of the three is actually Eve, but there are these multiple aspects because John uses what is sometimes called polyvalent symbolism, where a single symbol can refer to more than one thing. And I think this is an example of that. But one of the things it does refer to is the Virgin Mary.
Robert, Roberto, thank you so much for your question. We're going to go ahead and leave that right there. Patrick in South Carolina, if you can be quick, we can get you an answer because we are coming up to the end of the show. Go right ahead.
Hey, so Colossians 1:15 says that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. So my question for you, Jimmy, is really more opinion-based, but I was just curious if you think that maybe when God walked through the Garden of Eve and talked with Adam and Eve in person, or God visited Abraham with his two angels, was that Jesus pre-incarnate? Or what do you think that looked like?
Okay, so as always, I think the principle is try to figure out what a text means on its own term, in its own cultural context, before we try to relate it to later stuff. And in the Old Testament, the doctrine, as the Catechism points out, the doctrine of the Trinity had not been clearly revealed. That was something that was revealed with the coming of Christ. So Old Testament Jews were not thinking in terms of, there was some indication of a plurality within the Godhead. Like I mentioned earlier, there was a recognition that, okay, there's Yahweh, and then there's the second Yahweh or the lesser Yahweh, who's also God, but yet somehow distinct from God. But they didn't have a clear revelation of the Trinity. And so the starting point for biblical interpretation is figure out what did the human author mean. That's the literal sense of the text. Anything else beyond what the human author was aware of is the spiritual sense of the text. So in the literal sense of the text, the author of Genesis did not have a clear awareness of the Trinity. And in the Old Testament, whenever they referred to God, they tended to think of what of who we would call the Father. That's why Jesus says in John's Gospel, you believe in God, believe also in me. So the one they're already thinking of as God, that's his Father. And so based on that, you know, God in the Jewish mind was identified with the Father, and they didn't have a clear understanding of the Trinity, the logical interpretation of what did the author of Genesis mean in Genesis 3, where God walks in the garden, or later on, where God appears to Abraham, it would be that it's who we would call the Father doing that. Now, having said that, God is aware of more than what the human author is aware of. That's why there is a spiritual sense of the text. And so, you know, God is aware that he's a Trinity, and he knows about the Son. And so you could propose that the pre-incarnate Christ is referred to here, at least in the spiritual sense of the text. You could even propose that he's there in the literal sense of the text, but it's not, there's no obvious exegetical way to establish that, given the Jewish identification of the term God with the Father and the lack of a clear revelation of the Trinity. There's more that can be said about this, and also he'd get into the angel of the Lord, but we're at the end of the hour, so I'm afraid we'll have to do that another day.
Greg, thanks for your question, Patrick. Thank you for being quick as well. That's been 2 hours, Jimmy. Thank you so much for joining me. This was a lot of fun.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, when we come back next week, you'll get more of Cy Kellett, more of all the apologists that we have here at Catholic Answers. It's been a blast, and I hope you guys have a great weekend. Enjoy this beautiful Divine Mercy Sunday coming up. Keep us in prayer, and we will keep you in prayer. And this has been Catholic Answers Live.